Hello and welcome to this edition of Storyline, a podcast of Annenberg Radio News in the Media Center at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. I'm Matthew Tinoco. In this program, we go behind the ropes with a lifelong sparring partner. And we hear from a music student whose ears never stop ringing. But first, one rookie table tennis player is making a name for himself on social media. Reporter Megan Coyle spoke to Kevin Korb during his USC ping pong posse practice.
This is what Kevin Korb hears 30 hours a week, squeaky sneakers and the sound of a ping pong ball bouncing across the tennis table. Ping pong has pretty much taken over his life since he started playing less than 2 years ago. He goes to table tennis tournaments, he's president of the USC ping pong posse. Oh, and he's Instagram famous.
I hit the popular page on Instagram a couple times, and since then my follower account has increased to almost 18,000 people on Instagram, making me the largest table tennis related Instagram account by more than 10 or 11,000 people.
That fame doesn't just come from his tournament trophies. Korb's personality and unique playing style stand out in the sport.
I mean, I'm the tall, lanky white guy who doesn't seem to fit in with table tennis. I wear flashy outfits. I've got this, the bright orange. I've got neon shorts that I usually wear, and I'll go out to places and play trick shots that people normally wouldn't hit, which catches people off guard.
Korb started playing table tennis as a hobby his freshman year and learned from his teammates like Grant Lee, who was on the U.S. national team in 2012. Korb has no formal coaching, yet as an unranked freshman, shot up to an 1870 rating out of 2400 in his first year. And he had a stunning performance at last year's nationals.
But still, I was playing the other team's number two player. And went down, lost the first two games in a best out of five match, and then proceeded to lob them down to win the next three and come back, hitting the ball super high into the air and letting them smash it and kind of doing it until they would miss.
Korb's most recent accomplishment was a big upset of the number two seed in a tournament. Now his rating is over 2,000, putting him in the top 2,400 players in the country.
I'm getting invited over to successful businessmen's houses to go play ping pong with them, kind of entertain, going to represent different brands at tournaments.
These opportunities are rare for tennis table players, especially in the U.S. Table tennis gets little TV time in the States, and no American athlete has ever won an Olympic medal in the event. In fact, there are no Americans in the top 200 players in the world. On the other hand, countries like China groom table tennis players from a young age, and it's one of the most watched sports in the country. Korb can't compete with players like that.
It's hard. In the U.S., there's not as big of a market, especially having started only a year and a half ago, as opposed to people who've been playing for years and years and years. I realistically don't have a good shot of making it as a professional player.
Korb may not be headed to the Olympics, but his future in the sport will most likely involve the business partnerships and social media interaction he does now.
Appearances as a sort of celebrity, or maybe building it into a TV show of sorts, and we'll see where that takes me.
Until that reality TV show, Korb will first have to learn how to deal with that element of ping pong that does not fit his personality.
Interesting, because ping pong's a sport that's very, very robotic at times. So I can have a harder time in longer rallies making consistent attacks and consistent blocks, which is now what I'm starting to try to work on more and more to help get my game to the next level.
Luckily, he's got 17,000 Instagram followers to cheer him on. Megan Coyle, Annenberg Radio News.
You might hear a lot about the professional boxers who win championships, but what about the sparring partners who help them get to the top? MG Montemayor has this profile of a sparring partner who works in Los Angeles.
My last fight in the MGM Grand, that was the opening bout for the Canelo versus Lara.
Luis Bello says he used to be a scrawny kid who got beat up at school. Then he got his first taste at boxing at 8 years old. Now 21, he's been a pro for over 3 years, and his path to boxing seems almost inevitable.
It's always been in my family, and growing up, I'd see my dad going to the gym, and he'd take me when I was small. I was 11, 12, when I decided, hey, I'm going to do this all the way through.
Bello remembers his first sparring match vividly. He took on an older, more experienced fighter. His dad was there, too.
do what you have to do. He's like, if you're going to get hit, you're going to get hit. Like, there's nothing you can do about it. Like, this is boxing. You're bound to get hit. So I went there the first time. They say it's the make it or break it thing. Like, you either like it or you're like, this is not for me. So for me, like, I was like, I'm going to come back and I'm going to be better than that guy.
He committed to training and conditioning throughout his early teenage years. He then decided to become a sparring partner for the pros and discovered the boxing community is small, relying on word of mouth and a web of connections.
Well, here in Southern California, it's all connected. Everyone knows someone and they start making phone calls like, yeah, I need a sparring partner that's a southpaw, tall, at this weight. Okay, they're like, oh, I don't have one, but I think I know who might.
Eventually, he got his wish. At a young age, he was sparring with professional and world champion boxers, bouts that let him pick up techniques along the way.
Leo Santa Cruz, John Molina, Miguel Vasquez, and there's a lot, like, throughout my whole boxing career. They would dominate me, they'd land punches on me and everything, but it's a learning process, and it's, like, the hard way to learn. And you're getting, like, smacked around. They're playing with you, and you don't want to get played with. You want to be taken serious and actually connect some punches.
And when he was able to connect some punches and do well, he says it was a good feeling. Because of the sparring experience, Bello says he became a better boxer.
You learn from them, and then when you find someone kind of like at your level, what they did to you, you do to them now.
But being an amateur in the boxing world means having to earn respect.
Yeah, like, I go to the gym and then they'll look at me like, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, well, I came here to spar with John Molina. And they look at me like from head to toe like, oh, you're his sparring partner? I was like, yeah. After I was done sparring with him, oh, everyone started coming, like, hey, what's your name? How many fights you have? All this and that. Oh, that's so cool. Like, you're gonna be good. So I'm getting all these compliments. After they seen my work, the way you gotta do is you have to show them what you got, and that brings in people.
After several years as an amateur boxer refining his skills, at 18 years old, he finally went pro.
So I did a lot of private fights, and to this day, one of my private fights, I think it was like probably like one of my best fights. I fought some guy from Tahiti, a 6-round fight. He was undefeated, I was undefeated. I ended up winning, but it was a tough fight, but it's like those fights that you enjoy. As a boxer, you kind of like live for those fights.
Now 21, he looks back on the last few years and is thankful for the learning experience.
The best thing about boxing is, I guess, the way it molds you. You're more a confident person, like wherever you stand, like you're not really intimidated by anyone, and you have more security with yourself.
Job security is another matter. Sparring partners don't always get paid. So, Bello says if they have professional boxing dreams like he does, they have to consider every body shot, uppercut, and hook as an investment that could one day be worth its championship belt weight in gold. MG Montemayor, Annenberg Radio News.
Have you ever been to a concert and left with ringing in your ears? That's called tinnitus. And for millions of Americans, that ringing never goes away. Andy Fasoyan has this portrait of a USC music student living with the condition.
I've had tinnitus since I was in 10th grade, so that would be about 4 years now. Yeah, and I'm 19 now. So I went to a Mastodon concert, and they're like a metal band, and I was in the front row, and I was actually wearing earplugs, because I was like wary about my hearing before that, but still that didn't do a good enough job, so ever since then my ears have been ringing, so yeah. Like, it kind of was almost like my ear canal was swollen, and it was like I couldn't stick my finger like as far into my ear as I could normally, and they felt numb and they were ringing, and I was used to playing, like I said before, so I knew that like that was a feeling that generally would go away, but the ringing didn't. It's not loud enough for me to hear it during the day, so the only time that it bothers me really is at night before I go to bed. And if I play like a track, you know, from like an MP3 player, like through speakers, you know, like an ambient track, or if I'm listening to some music, I won't notice it. Some people say it sounds like screaming to them. It really just like depends on who the person is, you know, and the damage that was done. But mine is kind of like this, you know, like a shushing sound that never really like stops.
I'm Randall Bartlett. I'm an audiologist in private practice that specializes in tinnitus and sound sensitivity management. Tinnitus usually comes from some type of auditory injury.
Yeah, so I went to a Mastodon concert.
Or some type of injury to the brain.
And I was in the front row.
The auditory system can't differentiate between noise or sound comes in out from the real world from the noise that's being generated internally. There's about 40 to 50 million Americans who have very substantially noticeable tinnitus.
It's scary.
20%, it bothers them.
And it causes anxiety.
I mean, if you can imagine being imprisoned by a sound that you can't escape from.
Like for me, if I get really worked up about it, it seems to get worse.
Musicians have an unusually heightened sensitivity to sound.
I do jazz, that's what I study here.
They analyze sound.
I play metal stuff, like progressive stuff.
They're focused on sound.
I'm getting into like classical stuff.
Sound is their world.
I just got asked to be in a punk band.
The auditory cortex for a musician is much larger than it is for the average person.
So I really did run the board, you know, in terms of style.
So every nuance that's not right can be incredibly disturbing to them.
You know, it might be your favorite band or something, but it's like not worth it to lose your hearing like that. And like I say, you know, I have this condition and like you don't want it. If I could do that over again, I wouldn't have been in the front row. And I think about like that's the thing that really, I guess, bothers me the most, besides like the compounding noise at night. It's like I think about, man, that one experience, if I'd have just like, you know, stood a few rows back, not right by the speaker, I would be fine, you know? Or like, it wouldn't be like this. So, yeah.
That's it for this edition of Storyline. We're a podcast of Annenberg Radio News and the Media Center at USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. Taylor Haney is our producer, and I'm Matt Tinoco. Thanks for listening.